It's Burke Walker and the writer collaborators for Scaramouche, along with Bill Forrester, who designed the sets, and Ann Dexter Watson, who designed the costumes. Bob Scaramouche is being produced by the Empty Space Theater this fall, 1987.
Including our very own Bill Forrester for the occasion. And then Watson is doing the costumes. Bill Boy, the scene is on. Lights, too?
No, it's Rick Paulson.
Another man.
Another genius.
The Empty Space Theater, founded by Burke Walker, was founded back in about 1970 and has been from a very sort of easy beginnings in a sort of tiny hole down the Pike Place Market, has been easily probably the most interesting, challenging theater probably in the town. It is characteristically done. The first Stan Shepherd play that we got done, David Mamet the first time, Christopher Durang, Peter Hanke, and done with intelligence and often with real daring. On the shoulders of Burke Walker. Along with Burke are some of the people who have been associated along with not only this theater, the Empty Space Theater, but also distinguished actors and writers. And it's Bob Wright, Rex McDowell, Jim Monitor, in that order. If I say all fine actors, as well as good writers, of a very rare kind of combination. So I'm very pleased to be able to turn this over to Burke and his team to talk about their upcoming and first production of the year from Sabatini's Scaramouche, a new production of this.
Thank you, Bob. And Bob was my faculty advisor. Yes, we're proof of what can happen to you if you get a college degree. if you're not careful, yeah. You too could be a hero. We're going to sort of go around the table a little bit. Rex is going to kick things off since...
he was the last one here.
Since he was the last one here and we voted him first in line. He was also first in line with sort of his love of this particular story. And a good deal of the impetus for this adaptation has come from him. This impetus goes back a long ways, and I'll leave that up to him to unearth. Jim and Rex and Bob and to a small degree myself will talk about sort of the collaborative process so far and how we have worked to put this script together. And then I think all of us will sort of chip in towards the end and talk a little bit about where we're going with this particular project and what we're hoping it will achieve once it's up on the stage. Now, this is, of course, as Ann laughingly said, this is where we are today. We'll be somewhere else slightly different tomorrow and a little more different a week from now. And certainly by the time we open on November 24th, what we have explained to you may be radically changed in some particular instances. We'll talk until we run out of wind, and then hopefully there'll be plenty of time for your many, many questions, which you will be writing down, I'm sure. Okay, Rex McDowell?
Hi. We open in about 2 weeks.
No. Start rehearsal.
Start rehearsal in 2 weeks. That's what I meant to say. we've been writing, putting pencil to paper for about 4 years on this project in our spare time. The initial impetus came from the Empty Space Park shows, which started with the Venetian Twins in
1970.
I was in high school and did my first shot at the Empty Space in 71 while still in high school. Saw their first park show, collaborated on several of their other park shows in which they took bad scripts and made them worse, and people laughed at them, added music to little-known melodramas or adventures, and produced them in Volunteer Park on a shoestring budget, and did whatever they could to make them work. Somewhere during that time, in about 1976, I suggested that we do an adaptation of Raphael Sabatini's adventure history romance, Scaramouche, which was published in 1921 and was the book that made him famous. He also wrote Captain Blood and The Seahawk and several other very purple things that you may or may not have heard of or seen on the movie screen. We didn't do it at the time because we realized it would be much too large a project. We're doing it now because...
It's still too large a project.
I had some time on my hands a few years ago, and I asked Robert here if he had some time on his hands, and we decided to go ahead and start working on this project with no definite end in mind. Jim joined us soon thereafter. Bob and I had collaborated on four other scripts at this point, all of which were produced, but they were for the most part either science fiction and or children's stories. The Ming trilogy, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with.
Probably yeah. Seen them in your American theater magazine. It's
Ming the Rude, Ming Strikes Back.
And Beyond Ming.
Beyond Ming. Yes.
Back issues of American theater, I'm sure, have
those. Yes, you'll be able to find those. The Ming cycle, as it were.
That's right.
And also another script that the Empty Space produced twice, fools, The Day They Came From Way Out There, which is, of course was a science fiction musical adventure comedy parody. And so we've been working on this for about 4 years, and we are now... We're working on the fourth draft, the official fourth draft of the piece, and now it's no longer just a matter of spare time. The Empty Space has made us create more spare time so that we could work on the piece. What did you want me to talk about, Burke?
Why?
Why?
Oh, yeah. What interested you in the first place when you first made that suggestion 5 years ago or 8 years ago in park show?
Well, it seemed to me to be a story that would be very easily made worse, which I thought was a requisite for an Empty Space park show. But at that time, we were going to parody the piece. We would parody the piece and turn it into a comedy. Now we are trying to take the strengths of it, which is the history, the passion, the straight-ahead narrative, the melodrama, which, of course, is just whatever you want, heightened to the point where you can't possibly want anything else but what you immediately want, and use that and put that on stage and give that form some relevance for contemporary audiences. Which is what we've attempted to do
three times.
Now we're trying again. And we're getting there. We really are getting there.
Well, Jim and Bob, let's rescue Rex just a little
bit. Rescue me, I'm bored.
It's been a long 4 years, you know.
Needless to say, this collaborative process has not gone on day in and day out.
No.
But has had sort of spurts.
We did a first draft of the play, which took a long time because we literally did it sometimes once a week, sometimes a month was taken off. We'd do it in spurts when we didn't have work. And we got a first draft done, and then we had a reading of it at the Empty Space, which some people came and listened to and gave us some critical input. And from that, you know, Burke decided to utilize it as a grants proposal for the Performer Project. because he was interested in doing it. The Empty Space thought it was a nice idea, and it would be something that, when you think, most of the melodrama that at least I've been involved in and that I've seen has been melodrama like the park shows used to be, which was a heightened style but essentially tongue-in-cheek, where you threw out any kind of multi-layered reality, whether you were in the 1850s or not, or the 1920s. I mean, you could do anything to get a laugh. That was the idea. So they tended to be very vulgar and very bold and very body, and they were only an hour long, an hour and 10 minutes. So that when we started working on this, the challenge was to create a reality and a stylistic reality that was very consistent, that had something to do with classical melodrama, in the sense that the style would be very big and that the performances would be very strong and et cetera, et cetera, but that it wasn't going to be us winking at the audience saying, isn't this funny, or having a motorcycle ride on stage in 1789. I mean, that was something that we decided we wanted to be very straight with. And quite frankly, when we're writing, I mean, I wish we'd kept the file of all the dumb lines we can't use in this play, because our low tendencies constantly come to the surface. I mean, I know enough material back in the last 4 years to write two or three stupid park shows on this theme.
May I interject something?
Yes, Bill.
Give you a minute to collect your thoughts. When I first read this thing, I think I had a second draft, and it was very curious because it seemed to be an adventure melodrama kind of thing, but the stage directions were all written in this kind of crazy park show shorthand that was extremely funny. So my first question when I found out I had to be involved with this
we blackmailed him.
Was to ask Burke, what the hell is this show anyway? Is it supposed to be wacky and silly, or is this an adventure story?
Well, it's supposed to be an adventure story.
It's too bad the audience can't read the stage directions because they're quite funny.
Not anymore.
No, we've cut all that out. We had a very sort of embarrassing read-through of the third draft about 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, in which the person who was given the job of reading the stage directions like a fool went forward and read everything. And there's some stuff in there that we just, because we were working on a word processor, so you only see a screen at a time. You get to the end of the scene and you just go, okay, write it, and you write it and then you give it to somebody. And you forget that you've written all these really stupid, sometimes we just put them into like, to play jokes on people.
Amuse ourselves.
Or to amuse Burke or Kurt Beatty, who works at the Empty Space. We'll have little notes to Kurt and things. It's terrible.
At one point, I think the stage direction said that there will be people entering through the trap door, that is, if the space isn't too cheap to cut a hole in its floor.
Anyway, so there's a lot of stupid stuff that was read out loud.
Or introduction of a one-line character with, here's a good part for an intern.
And when you've got, you know, five or six interns reading the play for you, it doesn't exactly go the way you want.
Anyhow, you may wonder watching this how they got past the first scene, but they did. They have three complete drafts and are working on the fourth. Can you guys touch on the actual sort of writing process that the three of you, however cumbersome, go back and forth with?
Well, it's very interesting. I was talking to somebody about this the other day, is the fact that although we do tend to get very, very silly, one of the advantages of the three of us working together is that while two of us may take off on flights of fancy, one of us always manages to be the rock and bring us back to reality, or we'll sit there with the keypad in hand and just say, no, we can't possibly do that. So, oddly enough, it's usually Rex, but it tends to work, at least from my point of view, that with the three of us collaborating, there always seems to be two minds at work if one goes dormant. And
for months at a time.
For months at a time. I don't know, bail me out.
There's lots of pluses. Shut! There's lots of pluses
in
collab. No, no. There are lots of pluses in collaboration, and there are lots, I think there are some just built-in negatives. And the pluses are that if you come to a writing session and you're supposed to be there for 5 hours and you just don't feel like being there and your ideas are not any good and you're moping or whatever, there's usually someone there with the energy to bail you out, to get you going, to push you, and it's sort of like rehearsal. It's like getting to a rehearsal and just feeling a little morose, or even to a performance and not feeling like you're into it, and then having the process, the engine of the thing, take over, and it starts to kick you in the butt and you start moving. And as opposed to when you're writing by yourself, you're really by yourself, and you have to have a lot of discipline and a sort of, I think you have to build a structure of discipline that you know, a certain ritual that allows you to sit down no matter how you feel, no matter what kind of day it is, and do your work. And the negative parts of it are that it takes three times as long and you're never really happy. I'm not saying that we have days in which we really like what we've done.
There's one line you're happy with.
Yes, there is. There's several. There's a lot. I like the whole play, actually.
Yeah, that one in the middle of Act 2 that you like so much.
Yeah. No More Talking Devil Man?
No More Talking Devil Man. I like that line. And no, but I mean, I think it's true. You collaboration tends to, when you have a day or a moment when you think that it's really worked well, it's a nice feeling. I don't know if you get the same sort of feeling you get when, as one individual with one vision, you come away from writing a poem or a play or a couplet or whatever with the sense that you yourself have created this and that it's all yours and that it's all your intention. So there's that. And it takes a long time, too. It takes, you know, it's longer to have to clear everything with each other. Although sometimes we ride right over other people's you know, complaints. Sometimes we say, well, I don't care whether you like that or not. I think it's important. And then usually the people that have been saying I don't like that idea, well, if someone argues enough for it, it goes into the computer. Yeah.
The reason we are collaborating together is because we work together extensively on stage in the theater, come from a common theatrical, relatively common theatrical background, speak the same language, and have been able to work together and create together on stage, and felt we could probably do the same thing on the page. And I think that's an important part of this particular collaboration.
And I also think that one of the reasons that we have done this project, the reason that we wrote all those silly Ming plays, and was because we like to do certain kinds of things on stage. We were all in every one of those shows. We wrote it because, as performers, we had a common yearning to do something really ridiculous, probably. We enjoyed low humor. We enjoyed flights of fancy. And so we wrote the plays, and then so we could hire ourselves. And it's a great thing to do. Boy, if you're ever in a... I mean, it kept me in rent for several years in the summertime. I mean, for 4 years in a row, I was in a park show that I wrote. And it's, none of them were great. I mean, none of us are great writers by any means. At least I'm not. I can speak for myself. But it's, you know, that was the reason we did it. And I think the initial reason we got into writing the Sabatini thing is that we all liked the idea of writing a play that could be done seriously, with tremendous passion and lots of commitment and focus and utilizing all the tools you would use for going into a Greek drama, and yet it was going to be a big sort of sweeping romantic adventure. It's something that you don't often get a chance to do. I mean, the only thing, it's like you can do it in movies sometimes, but the process in the film is so helter-skelter and, you know, it's all sitting around. You never get any kind of sense of continuity of working on it. But to actually be able to do a sword fight and save somebody's life and die on stage and do it without, hopefully, bringing too many people to laughter, and actually trying to shoot for having people get choked up by all this stuff. It's not an easy thing to deal with without getting people to laugh at you, because people are not used to watching people display huge emotions and make grand physical choices without it being intentionally funny. So it'll be interesting to see if it works. I don't know.
You're all actors as well as writers. Do you also find an advantage to being able to sort of, once the scene is is down on the page, just to sit back and read it to each other and
act it out?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll never forget one day we wrote this piece of business. The entire second act takes place in a Commedia troupe. And we wrote this piece of business in which we see the play that they're performing. And Pantalone, the character, he faints. And all the other characters in the play want to make him think he's died. And one of the things they do is they stick sticks up his sleeves and up his pants so his extremities are stiff when he wakes up. And so we were curious to see if this would work as a piece of business. So Rex then proceeded to act out him waking up and then trying to stand upright.
It's like science. It's like verifying through lab experiment, you know.
That's right.
It was very, very funny.
Yes, it will work.
It will work. And it's also amazing when we hear it read out loud by other actors. All the stuff that we hoped to God would work, and it doesn't.
And it's not just them.
But it is going to be an interesting process during rehearsal, because I have found during the audition process that although you sort of read it on the page and it reads like, you know, romantic adventure, not purple prose, but it's definitely, you're not talking Henry Fielding here. It does take a kind of Shakespearean energy to animate it. And that when people came through and kind of treated it like realism, it really never did get off the ground. That it is, these are heroic situations, even if it is in a sort of pulp fiction context. The thing that Bob mentioned, I want to get back to and use as a segue to the next part of our little informal presentation about this is something that the films usually do. This is actually one of the sort of very calculated reasons that we are behind this project and are investing so much energy into it. Is that for better or for worse, we would like for the period of a month that this play is going to run to reclaim part of that territory momentarily for the theater, the area of adventure romance has been taken over so exclusively by films of late that we sort of forget that the theater used to do this all the time. And we're very much interested in sort of reclaiming a part of that a part of that turf. We have chosen, and I want to give Bill and Anne a chance to sort of walk through some of the scenic elements. In terms of an adventure romance, or I like to look at it also as the whole sort of adventure romance genre being a kind of adult fairy tale, where morality or morality play, to see this acted out, we have decided to literally invade the turf of the films, and in fact the set for the play, those of you who have been to the space know we have this big, large empty space that's about 70 feet square and 20 feet in height. We plan to use the entire room as best we can, as if it were a soundstage for a film. That through a way that we have yet to finalize, in some way this space will be invaded or taken over by the people who are telling the story that's in front of us. But that we are in fact, if not on the set of the Stuart Granger 1952 Technicolor version of the film, we are nearby. This is sort of MGM Studio B is where we are setting our location here. On sheer logistics, It's a commanding and daunting project in that we have a fairly large size cast, between 16 and 18, depending on how many of the ASMs we can get on stage during a given crowd scene. There will be three acts and somewhere between 16 and 20 separate scenes, depending on what does or doesn't happen to a possible consolidation of some scenes in the third act.
Forget the consolidation.
20 scenes. Somewhere around 20 scenes. Those of you who... I'll turn this over to Rex for a minute to give you sort of the 120-second capsule plot review. Jim mentioned that the second act takes place mostly while the lead character is hiding out in a comedia troupe, a traveling comedia troupe. My rough count, there are a couple of elements that this production is going to involve us heavily in. One is going to be stage combat, and the other is going to be some version or other of commedia. I say that loosely because historically, at this point, the last major Italian influence was almost 100 years prior to the time that Sabatini has set this play. And at that point, even the leader of the troupe Binet in Sabatini's novel acknowledges that they are attempting to revive the ancient Italian art of improvisation. But the historically, Italian commedia, strictly speaking, was very much on the way out, and for a period of at least 50 to 60 years, had been watered down and bastardized through a series of influences, mostly from comic opera and then from English pantomime at various periods, depending in some degree or not on what was happening with the patent houses in Paris, who, you, from your theater history, you may know that there were two or three houses in Paris who had exclusive contracts to do certain kinds of theater, and that if they had that contract, that other people could not do that kind of theater. For example, spoken French drama classics was strictly reserved for the Théâtre Français, or otherwise known as the Comédie Française. So this is a traveling provincial troupe, which is now at the end of about three generations of other influences, and we will come out of it with some version or other of late 18th century bastardized commedia.
Late 20th century, but Fantasy Space Park show.
Yeah,
right.
Read that.
But that, at the combat level, we have at last count two riots, three full-scale duels, and one fencing academy tournament that includes seven separate matches. We are bringing in one of our major collaborators, who's not at the table here, Alan Suddeth. From New York City, who is one of the better point men in the country in terms of teaching us and choreographing for us the court fencing, the court sword point work that is required of this particular era. This is not Three Musketeers, you know, lunge and heave and huff and puff. It's very contained and refined, and Jim, you can talk about that for a little bit.
Oh, okay.
It's you.
Well, the court sword, literally, that's where the name comes from. They wore it in court, and it was designed to go along with their clothes and everything, and it evolved into the foil when duels were outlawed at the end of the 1700s. At this particular period in time, roughly 7,000 people a year were killed in duels. The blade of the weapon is very long, very thin, and this made for very almost delicate movements. It's all in the wrist, and it's all real, very deliberate. Very finesse is the word that you connect with this. Alan, as a fight choreographer, is somebody I worked with for 5 years in New York. In fact, I was one of the co-founders of a group that we started called Fights Are Us. And we worked, we did several shows, Night at the Fights, Smash Hits, and based upon stage combat and different periods of stuff. But when it comes to the very, very delicate point and work that this particular style calls for, Alan is hands down the best. It's also very interesting that by writing an adaptation of Scaramouche, we have now doubled the volume of plays that Court Swords can be used in. The other is The Rivals, and that's about it. But it's a very, very fascinating style. It'll be real interesting. We're working now, we'll have approximately 3 weeks in which we're working in workshops with Alan's assistant before he comes in town, just learning the basics of how it all works, because all the parries and all the thrusting and stuff is very, very specific and quite different from what you use with sabers and musketeer blades and all that kind of stuff.
Bill, would you and Ann like to?
Or do you want the storyline? Want to get Rex? Tell the story.
Give the story a little bit, so that those of you who don't know.
Does anybody know the story?
Yep.
Yeah. See.
Uh-oh.
All right. Tell you.
See, it'll be a surprise.
Late night movie. Stuart Granger.
All right.
Oh, terrible.
1952.
Mo, Larry, and Curly come out.
A silent film adaptation in the early 20s. I forget who played Scaramouche.
Ramon Navarro.
Louis Stone.
Or you could read the book.
And there was a early 1960 adaptation by
some
French
Italian
filmmakers. French or Franco-Italian with, I think, Alain Delon.
Yeah. The story, France, 1789, April, late afternoon. André-Louis Moreau, a illegitimate son of somebody we don't know, who's been raised by a minor noble, finds himself cradling the body of his best friend, a divinity student who has just been murdered by the greatest swordsman in all France, the Marquis de la Tour d'Azyr, a very wealthy and powerful nobleman in Brittany. He vows revenge and through a series of circumstances causes a riot, has to flee, finds shelter with a traveling Commedia troupe, spends Act Two with them. That brings us...
He very rapidly becomes their leading actor and playwright.
He's a real paragon. And at the end of Act Two, he finds himself confronted with the Marquis de la Tour d'Azyr again. There is another riot. We're big on riots. And he has to flee again, this time as a wanted, been a wanted felon, now he's a wanted for sedition and treason. And he spends the next 2 years in a fencing academy, learning to fence. We don't see that, because that would take too long.
That happens during the intermission.
That's intermission. While you drink coffee, he becomes the greatest swordsman in all France. And he becomes a member of the National Assembly, which is the body, the representative body, which is attempting to change the laws of France, basically, and avert the bloodbath, which they fail to avert. He becomes a representative of the Third Estate, or the bourgeois, or the poor people, however you want to think about it. And he's brought into the Assembly to kill the nobles who are attempting to legislate with their blades, killing all the leading lights of the Third Estate. This leads to a confrontation with the Marquis and the revelation of who, in fact, he is. It's really swell.
That's about it. Gee, it took 4 years to do that.
Yeah.
November 1983.
One of the fascinating aspects of this for us has, I mean, he's at its sort of adult fairy tale level. You have the story of a young man's journey through life in search of who he is. He does not know his parents. And this is very much a journey of discovery for him. And there is just barely below the surface, I think, a great deal of private rage and turmoil, which is reflected also in the political backdrop of the story. And we're hoping that certainly one of the things we achieve with our production is to bring a little bit more of the sort of contemporary 20th century interest in why he takes the actions that he does, in addition to just what he does.
And politically, you know, I mean, you can draw all sorts of lovely allegories between the fact that the French Revolution was really a product of the bourgeoisie, who had not really the peasants, who didn't really get involved in it until the late part of the revolution. The bourgeoisie, who had risen in power, had gotten more money, had become more affluent, and sort of were within reach of people like the nobility, were the ones who wanted more. And they'd gotten the taste of what it was like to have power, and they wanted to more governmental power, more money, more whatever. And, you know, like that, André-Louis Moreau is a young man who, raised by a nobleman, but because of his lack of paternity, was not allowed to have any of the things that he saw around him. And if so, and because of that, has this sort of visceral through line, this rage that he has about the fact that he's a bastard, and then everything that happens in the play, it's a sort of a self-fulfilling destiny that he tends to destroy everything around him, and then he gets angrier and angrier, and eventually gets to confront that.
There's a certain amount of aggression in all three of the identities that he selects, starting out in the first act as a lawyer, and then becoming an actor, and then literally becoming an assassin, working for the forces of revolution, and that there's we are trying to acknowledge as much as possible the strong personal psychological needs that are pushing him in the directions that he's going, and to make the choices that he's making. Now, Mr. Bill. Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about how we're using the space, and we have pictures to flash here.
I won't run through all 21 scenes and move all the little pieces around. what we tried to do, well, when I first talked with Bert, and he said, well, we're going to, I think, use the device of a movie studio, I went away thinking, now, how can I talk Bert out of this one? And I came back a week later hoping maybe he'd forgotten that we'd gone something else, but Bert does not forget. And the more I thought about it, I had nothing else to offer which might help solve our problems other than the movie approach, so we have gone with it for better or worse. Right now it seems like a good idea. What we came up with was the thing that makes a movie studio look like a movie studio is that they have these catwalks going around. They're fairly low, actually, and they mount lights on them. And other than that, it's sort of a big empty room with a lot of stuff piled around. So the thing that really makes a theater different from the movie studio at this point is the fact that there are these catwalks, which you don't get in a theater. Mm-hmm. So the major acting space is between these catwalks, which are at a level 10 feet above the stage, and we are going to store the various pieces which were made for the movie Scaramouche, out around the side, and then the actors and the stagehands and the interns and the ASMs will scoot things on and off as we need them in the major playing area, and then they'll just store over here, still within sight. Let's see, beyond that...
None of it is masked. It also is going to, I think, give us a great deal of freedom in terms of how we treat each of the scenes with sort of more or less detail. It would certainly be feasible, for instance, if we had a garden setting, for us to just deal with a very limited amount of detail right near where the actors are, as if we were almost in camera close up, and then have the rest of it fade away, or not be finished.
think the lighting is going to play a considerable role in focusing our attention on this rather fragmentary group of sets that we have in order to make it all come together and make it magic. And beyond that, without getting into detail,
that was our initial concept. When Burke raised the objection of how many scenes there were, of course, we said, lights and sound, Burke. No problem.
It's one of the problems about being actors, too, is that, and it's something we keep butting our heads up against, is we will write a scene or even a line, and we'll look at it and go, well, I could make that work, you know, and whether or not that's true, is, as an actor, you're constantly thinking, well, if we just get the right cast, they can make this incredibly clumsy scene work. And it's not always true. And in fact, Kurt Beatty, who is the dramaturg, literary manager, and a wonderful actor in his own right, said the empty space was the first to point out to us, you know, you can't rely on the fact that your actors are going to fix it for you. And that's constantly what we've been, not all the time, but a lot of time we go, well, no, I think this really can work. And I think sometimes we're right, other times we're fooling ourselves. And when you hear people who are perfectly decent read a play and just like stop like they've been hit with a truck in the middle of the scene, because they just go, what? What does this mean? And then you realize, oh, well, the scene's, okay, we need more work. So they're going to give us all sorts of wonderful things to play on, and that'll make it a lot better.
But, we have these. Yeah, I can just flash through these. In no particular, well, in some kind of sequence. This is an Act One scene where you're looking at the exterior of a prosecutor's office. This is a unit that will actually twirl around so that we'll start out the scene playing an interior on that platform. While there's a mob chanting outside the window, the unit turns around during mid-scene and the point of view shifts, and you're then on the outside, so that you've got one actor here yelling at him, he's yelling at the mob, the mob's down there, it's all sort of triangulated. Part of that same unit is used in a barn scene. This is sort of one of the notions of the National Assembly. Which is a major unit, kind of looks like this room, but a major unit for the president and the speaker, and we hope to also get our audience polarized during those particular scenes, because when you talk about right and left wing, those terms originated in the French National Assembly, where the nobles sat on one side and the Third Estate sat on the other side. This is a scene that takes place. It's a little hard to pick out.
Yeah, I bet.
You can probably see this fly on this woman's coat here.
This is a party at a nobleman's house, a garden scene. This is a scene that takes place inside a theater at the end of the second act, where the André confronts the Marquis. This is a scene early in the second act where they're playing in a farmyard. There's a couple of progressions in the play. One through the first, second, and third acts is sort of from the country to the town to the city. And that's also mirrored in the second act where they go from playing to two pig herds in a farmyard to playing in a town square to playing in the Théâtre Breton. With fancy new costumes. And speaking of fancy new costumes,
I'm going to back up a little bit just to make the point of what it is like working with three wonderful collaborators on what in fact is a new play and changing minutely. The Empty Space does a neat thing that not all theaters do. When they ask you to do a show, they insist, and as well they might, that you read the script and take a good long look and think about it before you commit to it. So, dutiful person that I was, I did that and made long lists of the long number of people that were on, discovered from page to page. And in fact, most of those lists are now in the wastebasket because those characters aren't in the show anymore. But when I entered the process at the point Bill started talking about, and there was the discussion about entrapping this within the movie context or the movie studio context, I kept asking questions and not really getting answers about how really the costume should then fit into that. Did we want to do bright, shiny 1950s costumes that bore fairly scant reality or to what the real costumes were? Did we want to pretend that in fact the costumes, like the scenery pieces, were laying around on racks on the sides and people actually went and got them, either from movie house stock or actually the costumes made for the movie Scaramouche, et cetera, et cetera. And we sort of decided that that part of it didn't really work for what the costumes wanted to be. What the costumes truly wanted to be was a wonderful, historical, terribly romantic period look at what this time was about. There's a lot that bespeaks of the romance that is wanted in the end result feeling in the close of this time, and we pretty much took ourselves back to that. If we are taking it in any direction, it is to make the romantic as it can possibly be, both in lowercase terms as well as nobility terms. Beyond that, I have been drawing for a good long while, not so much because things have changed, actually, because I decided Andre was not going to change, so I started there and drew all of his clothes and sort of worked out using him as a pivot. It's been for me, a truly wonderful design experience. It's one of the few times where it sort of actually has been happening like they teach you in school. I went away and did some sketches, and in all cases, I've done it sort of in groups that made sense, but in all cases, I've gone to Berg with my first ideas, and we've had really good discussions sparked by what I had on paper. Half of it was wrong, but at least was there to talk about, and I went away with what we had spoken of and came back, and almost every time after those discussions, things are being accepted, and it's truly been a concrete and good design experience that way. With the designs mostly in hand, what I have to show you, and it's probably easier for you to come up, this pile of Xeroxes is all of the designs that exist to date. The other pile is essentially the second act. The others are, in fact, being built even as we speak, and sketches were needed elsewhere. What was I going to say? Oh, beyond the design is really a logistical problem. Burke has also been wonderful in working with me to establish a chart that takes these 16, we've got 18 actors through the over 100 costumes that really exist in the course of the production. It's been a hard job, and he's been really good about it. We do know where we're going, we do know who's who at what given time, and that it can in fact work. We have been doing it way ahead of time. You've heard that rehearsals aren't going to start for 2 weeks. Usually costume production begins at about the same time, but we have purposely, because the empty space has smaller facilities than a lot of places, started ahead of time, calling actors in for measurements ahead of time, and things are on their way.
I can make one closing comment. I'm sorry we don't have time for questions. The space has a long and cherished history. Including our park shows, of working with material that definitely has its sources and its roots in popular culture. And we see this as another venture into that area because we think it's an important part of the world we live in and one that we relate to quite readily. Yeah. If you could leave quietly, so that the sleepers may continue their naps.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I wish we got as much, I wish when we had a second conversation, Bert, he was that long.